Hey, it's Bantam. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that we are going to try something new this week. Since it's Thanksgiving weekend, I wanted to give you some extra content as you recover from the holiday or travel home from visiting with friends and family. Enjoy two additional episodes of the Digital Song Podcast. Now, we are ready to hack destiny. Jason. When Jason and Corrine arrived at Disco Ardent, a queue of people murmured below a golden tube light contorted into the shape of an apple, which pulsed rhythmically above the club's main door. The queue moved quickly, and once Jason and Corrine reached the portal into this world that straddled deep night and dawn, the bouncer who guarded the entrance waved a baton over each of their UDs, and then they were permitted to enter the vibing sensory scene. Jason could feel the music reverberating through the immense airplane hangar-sized space as bass vibrated up through his bones from the ground, the hairs on his arms buzzing from the waves of sound pumped from the giant amplifiers. Streaks of light bounced and sliced across the hundreds of entranced people dancing. Corrine guided Jason through the party, ducking and turning between the undulating pillars of flesh and neon cloth. He was in a haze. He could not hear, except for the repetitive house music beat that tapped almost twice per second. As he blindly followed Corrine through the crowd and the sensations of fatigue started to mingle with those of intoxication, the compass rose dream images crept back into his vision, superimposed over the world he saw like a foreboding Instagram filter. Corrine and Jason navigated through the people and sat at the bar. Corrine rummaged through her bag and retrieved a small cylinder, not dissimilar to a lipstick applicator. She unscrewed it and turned it upside down, allowing several small circular white pills to drop into her palm. She kept two in her hand, poured the others back into the little container, then immediately placed one in her mouth. She lifted the other pill to Jason's mouth, which he opened, accepting the pill on his tongue, then swallowing it. The gigantic space included a seating area with long couches and chairs, a dance floor where the DJ stood on a dais behind two vinyl decks outlined in fluorescent lines in front of a couple hundred people, a small rectangular bar in the corner, and a VIP section cordoned off by brass poles and velvet rope. Jason noticed in the VIP section two large and muscular men who looked like bodyguards surrounding a small woman with large round glasses, olive skin, short platinum blonde hair with black streaks and a wide, toothy smile. Each time a beam of light strafed across her face, he could see she had golden irises. The golden-eyed woman was seated, wearing a white t-shirt with a graphic on the front. Her chin was tilted downward, but her gaze seemed to be angled upward, resulting in a menacing stare across the room. Suddenly, a surge of euphoria shot through Jason's body. Sure that it was the drugs taking effect, he deactivated ThoughtLock and mentally inquired about his physiological state from Branch. He looked at his UD, which told him that he was fatigued, his energy levels had dropped at a consistent rate for the past hour, and that he had a 0.15 blood alcohol content and moderate levels of MDMA in his bloodstream. The alcohol mixed with Molly seemed to ameliorate his anxiety from the dreams. Over the course of the blurred night, Corrine introduced Jason to various friends.
"You should ask these people about that Pyramid Club,"
she suggested.
"Pyramid Club."
It was a good moniker for whatever establishment lay behind the red door and its pyramid and star symbol. Jason tried several times to broach the subject with Corrine's friends, but nobody recognized his descriptions. When he bumped against the legs of the people seated on couches, he asked them if they had ever been to a pyramid club. He wandered around the populated warehouse, weaving through dancing bodies on the dance floor, trying not to let his bourbon on the rocks fall or spill, asking people the same question over and over. His inquiries bore only stares, sneers, and shrugs. He strode by the entrance to the cordoned-off VIP section en route to the bar area just beyond it. As he crossed its entrance, he almost collided with a group traveling the opposite direction. He stopped short, almost crashing into the two muscular bodyguards and the golden-eyed woman, who also halted. The bodyguards jerked their heads to peer at Jason, but it was the golden-eyed woman's freaky face that caught Jason's attention. Her golden irises flickered like a ring of embers as she stared at him, her chin tilted down, looking out of the tops of her eyes, grinning fang-like teeth exposed. She was much shorter than he, but notwithstanding her diminutive frame, she projected a large physicality. They locked eyes, and Jason studied the woman's face and figure. Her irises were actually golden. Her white V-neck t-shirt depicted a stylized golden outline of an apple with the words, "The Fairest," written in florid calligraphy below it. The moment in which the woman and Jason swapped gazes lasted a long time to him. Numerous beams of light flashed and disappeared in the background as she stared at him out of the tops of her eyes, the light reflecting on her bleach-white teeth. Then events unfolded in rapid succession. One of the bodyguards pushed Jason's shoulder. He stumbled backwards as his bourbon sloshed in its tumbler, spilling onto his hand and the ground.
"Back off, bro,"
the large man said, stepping so close to Jason that he could feel the humid warmth of the man's breath on his face. The bodyguard quickly lifted the bottom of his black V-neck, exposing the grip of a cobalt pistol tucked into the waistband of his dark jeans. The golden-eyed woman, still staring, stepped up to Jason, then grabbed his shoulder and yanked his body down so his neck was near her mouth, as if she were going to take a bite out of his jugular.
"Watch yourself!"
Jason heard her voice in his ear over the loud music as if the room were silent. He felt a rigid object pushing on his leg near his groin, so looked down to see the flat edge of a shiny blade pressed into his leg, the handle held by the tiny woman. Suddenly, she pulled the blade back, turned away, and strode into the VIP area, flanked by her two large bodyguards. Jason froze with shock, realizing that he had been on the brink of a fight. Just then, he felt soft hands on his forearm, and he looked up. It was Corrine.
"You okay?"
Corrine asked Jason loudly.
"I'm all right. You saw that?"
"Yeah."
She pulled him protectively by the arm, escorting him back to the bar where they had been standing before Jason meandered around the venue.
"Who the fuck was that?"
Jason asked Corrine, still shaken by the encounter.
"I have no idea,"
Corrine squeaked. Jason stood at the bar, stared past the back wall of the bar area at some distant vanishing point.
"Do you need anything?"
she asked, eyebrows rounded with concern.
"No, I'm good,"
Jason said, still absently staring ahead. He gulped the remaining whiskey from his tumbler, then turned to Corrine.
"I'm gonna head out,"
he said loudly. As he leaned in with one arm to hug Corrine, she reached up and wrapped her arms around the top of his back, stepping onto her tiptoes to complete the embrace.
"Let's talk soon,"
Jason said. Corrine moved her hands to Jason's head, pulling it down closer to her face.
"I hope you find what you're looking for, Jason."
The two separated and looked at each other for a moment as Jason took her hand, squeezed lightly, then dropped it before walking away. Jason, intoxicated and careworn, peered out of the window of the A-taxi on his way home, and it was as if he could see Rose's face as a reflection in the window as dirty Brooklyn streets streaked by behind it. The voice of a singer crooning a foreboding and melancholy tune took root in the auditory centers of his brain, even though the I-taxi was soundless. He knew that he would see Rose again in his sleep that night. He had seen her every night for the past several months. It was a certainty. In his room, in his frustration and withdrawal from the chemicals and the torment of the dreams, Jason stood, looking at himself in the mirror, his face gaunt, his eyelids puffy.
"What the fuck is happening to my life?"
he wondered out loud to himself. Chapter 13, When the Party's Over. Rose. In her room, Rose sat in front of a vanity, makeup strewn across the counter space around a tall glass of golden, effervescent champagne in a flute glass. Her red ensemble covered one shoulder and exposed the compass rose tattoo on the other side, just below her collarbone and above her heart. She continued to deconstruct her stage persona, removing various pieces of jewelry, bending down slowly to unbuckle her stilettos, erasing the layers of makeup she had applied, loosening her hairstyle. She slowly transformed from butterfly back into caterpillar, her nondescript and ordinary outfit, athleisure pants, white V-neck, and wool-lined boots, blended in with the other 10 million humans in the city. Muffled steps clanged against the steel spiral stairs outside the entryway to her room. A conscientious, almost reticent three-rap knock drew her attention.
It must be Easton,
she thought. Virtually no one else had access to the back areas of the club.
Hey, Rosebud,
Easton said in a soft tone.
It's me.
Come on in, Easton.
She continued her routine, rubbing makeup off her cheeks with a remover wipe as she looked in the mirror at Easton, who gently opened the door and stepped in.
I just wanted to tell you that it was a great performance.
Thanks.
Rose could see Easton's reflection in the mirror. He smiled with one side of his face, seemingly focused on some image or memory.
It's funny seeing you up there tonight. It made me think of the first time I saw you perform as a kid.
Rose put down the makeup removal pad and turned around in her chair to face him.
When I sang Memory from Cats in School?
Yes, that was it.
Easton smiled.
It was magnificent.
His eyes drifted to the ground and his smile faded.
You had just moved in with me after your father died. It was such a tough time. You felt this strong sense of guilt for what happened. Like, somehow it was all your fault. We were just starting to get to know each other. Even after a few months, you were still coping with what happened. I remember at some point, I asked what activities you enjoyed, and you said, I love to sing. I asked you what you liked to sing, and you told me all about Adele and Amy Winehouse.
I remember that.
Though she missed her father, Easton had become the paternal figure in her life, and she thought of him as her dad.
I was so sad and scared, but I remember your patience and warmth. But that night, that was the first time I thought, this place can be home for me.
That makes sense, because you seemed to feel more comfortable after that, though you were still clearly grieving. A few weeks later, you told me about a talent show at school and asked me if you could perform. When I said yes, you smiled from ear to ear and hugged me so tightly I couldn't breathe. It was the first time I had seen you happy since you came to live with me. Funny, though, you said you wanted to surprise me, so you wouldn't let me listen when you practiced.
I wanted you to get the full experience like the rest of the audience.
Full experience is right. A few weeks later, you stunned everyone in the auditorium at school, including me. You were just a little girl, but your voice was so powerful and emotional. I remember the shivers down my spine. But mostly I remember the crowd shooting to their feet when you were done. I could never forget the big grin on your face before you bowed. I thought, she's a star.
I haven't thought about that performance in so long,
Rose said quietly, trying to picture the school stage bathed in light, the microphone on its stand in front of the curtain, and the hundreds of faces watching from the audience.
And I was right. You are a star. From that day forward, each time you performed a song, it was an absolute joy.
Thanks for believing in me.
She felt a comforting warmth in her chest.
Without you, I'd have nobody in my life.
You know I'd do anything for you. Come here,
Easton said. Rose got up from her seat, walked to Easton, and gave him a hug. It made her feel like that little girl again, safe from the tragedies of the world.
Have a good night. Get some relaxation time in. You deserve it.
He took a split-second pause before saying,
I love you, Rosebud.
I love you too,
Rose said as they separated from the hug.
Branch me tomorrow when you're free.
I will.
Easton nodded and backed out of the room, shutting the door behind him. Rose could hear Easton's footsteps circling down the steel spiral staircase away from her room. When she finished tidying her quarters, she grabbed her tan bag, hoisted the strap over her head, and readied herself to leave through the metal security door into the crisp winter air of Brooklyn. Her personal entrance led down into the courtyard, which was a quicker escape than winding through the labyrinthine corridors of the club and exiting through the front. She emerged from between the brick warehouse walls to an open concrete parking lot area illuminated by tall metal streetlights. As she walked through the cones of light, she reached into her bag and fished through the inner lining pocket, grabbing her UD and activating it with a slide of her finger along its side. Rose had special UD permissions built into the club's security framework that allowed her to possess her UD inside the club, while the patrons were prohibited to enter with theirs. If a member mistakenly carried his or UD into the club, all transmissions sent or received by the UD would be jammed as a part of the club's security, rendering his or UD effectively useless before being confiscated. For Rose, even with her high-level administrative access, she could not text, call, message, use social media, or browse Web 5. She had to get sufficiently far away from the club to activate her UD and use it because of the club's signal jamming bubble. When she walked outside the radius of the bubble, she pictured her thought lock code, microphone, grass 4, element, circle, direction, red, and ordered an AI taxi with her thoughts using Branch. She had mastered the timing of leaving the club, activating her UD on the walk, and calling the AI taxi as soon as she emerged from the signal jamming radius. Rose felt safer in AI taxis because they were not controlled by humans. She preferred the anonymity and privacy accorded by dumb AI on AI taxi rides. The car asked no questions, it did not gaze at her, it did not speak, and it did not look human. Rose did not worry for her safety even in the slightest. The nondescript orange sedan decelerated at an almost painfully reasonable rate and slowly pulled up to the curb in front of her. She held her UD up to the passenger door key panel, and it opened smoothly. She stepped in immediately, and at the same time, a warm, asexual voice chimed, "Welcome, AI Taxi Rider," as "Hello, Rose" scrolled across the digital display on the front dashboard. Rose slid into place behind the front passenger seat, which was pulled forward, giving her enough leg room to stretch her legs to the point of locking her knees. She loved to watch out of the window as the lights of Manhattan grew brighter during the drive west from Deep Brooklyn to her home in Fort Greene. It gave her a moment to think about how New York, the cultural center of modern global society, was simultaneously futuristic and pinned in the past. As the brightly lit streets streaked by, Rose could not stop her mind from concentrating on the loneliness of living in the vast metropolis. Her brief discussion with Easton had awakened old guilt and pain born from the traumas of her childhood. Though as an adult, she had fought back emotions that haunted and taunted her. As a child, she had been chained to the feeling of fault for her mom's abandonment. Her heart told her she was responsible, no matter how many times her dad had reassured her. When the car crash took his life, the injustices of the world seemed to collapse upon her. It was Easton who dug her out from the weight of the pain, shielded her from its onslaught, and cultivated her germination into the businesswoman and artist she was today. Nevertheless, she had not found a partner, a person around whom she could be herself. Someone to push her to pursue new business ideas or take art classes, someone who could share her bed with her so she would not have to tumble into the world of sleep alone. Someone who would cook for her and make her laugh. The thought of loneliness caused the sad voice of Billie Eilish to sound in her head, narrating her commute home. Sometimes she truly believed she liked being on her own, but she also yearned for the touch, communication, company, and intimacy of another. She had lovers in her past and she enjoyed those times, but none of them had fit into her heart's puzzle. She had Easton, but the attachment she had to him was grounded in a parental love. She wanted a companion, someone to extract the stone of guilt and pain deeply lodged in her soul, stitch her emotional wounds closed, hold her hand, provide a soft notch between chest and shoulder for her chin to rest upon, caress her hair. When the horror vectors of chance or fate or inevitability or unfairness would collide with her own life's trajectory, she wanted someone to reassure her, tell her everything would be okay. She was expected to be strong, but she didn't want to have to be strong all the time. The AI taxi weaved through Brooklyn, stopping and starting at streetlights as the sound of the rolling wheels whirred against the pavement. Rose lived on a quiet street near Fort Greene Park in a sand-colored brownstone only a few miles from the Pyramid Club. As the AI taxi pulled up to her house on Carlton Avenue, Rose unbuckled her seatbelt and opened the AI taxi door as it halted after gradually slowing down. She climbed the large steps to her house, flicked her UD out in front of the security panel, and entered the house when the door unlocked automatically as the panel beeped quietly.
Home again,
she thought. She walked through the vestibule into the dimly illuminated living room, eyes heavy with exhaustion, and hung her bag on a large hook by the door. She shimmied her vert goose jacket off her shoulders and let it fall to the floor. She kicked off her shoes and rolled onto the couch, facing the digital fireplace, which was a black screen panel covering the area where a traditional hearth had been, with dancing digital flames leaping and flickering.
Is home a place, or is home your person?
She thought.
I am ready to share my life with someone. I'm ready to find my home.
Rose curled up with her head on one of the throw pillows and fell asleep as the artificial firelight projected onto her face. Around her, the invisible currents of time and fate churned, waves of events pounding against each other in a building storm. Like an unsuspecting swimmer in a riptide, Rose was about to be violently pulled into the powerful churning ocean of destiny and circumstance. Chapter 14, In My Dreams. Jason sat at a wooden table in a sterile courtroom next to Mac, awaiting the result of the hearing. Judge Hellis would determine if the search of Mac's Tesla by police violated his constitutional rights. Mac sat at the defense table with Jason like a funeral goer in his dark suit, anxiously awaiting to hear the judge's ruling. Jason looked gaunt and malnourished, like a skull with eyes, nose, ears, lips, and hair. The image of Rose, this phantom woman from his dreams, tortured him daily. It was the only thing that he could think about besides Mac's hearing. Jason's willpower fed on the hope that he might earn his reward from Geo Mason, and it would somehow steer him toward finding Rose and the Pyramid Club.
It's all connected,
Jason thought.
The dreams, this case, the symbols.
He had executed his plan for the hearing masterfully. He had presented video evidence from Sally's bar showing Mac's perfect adherence to traffic laws. The officer's lies were so egregious that after Jason's cross-examination, the judge had berated Brodson, the prosecutor, for his witness's perjury and strongly encouraged Brodson to dismiss the case.
Anton would be proud,
Jason thought fleetingly. Waiting for the judge felt like an eternity. The stillness of the crowd in the windowless courtroom buttressed the illusion of frozen time. The audience began to murmur quietly, and Jason thought about Rose. He tried to swipe past the thought, like scrolling through posts on the socials, but the images seemed fixed in his mind's screen. He could see Rose's visage, beautiful and somehow bright in death. Her face distracted him.
So?
Mac asked quietly. Jason could detect his anxiety.
It's looking good,
he said.
But for now, we wait.
Jason thumbed open his small moleskin notebook that he always kept in his pocket and started drawing the tattoo of the compass rose over and over on the same page. Mac leaned over Jason's forearm as he drew with extreme concentration.
What are you drawing?
Mac asked. Before Jason could answer, the courtroom bailiff bellowed,
All rise.
She commanded in a deep voice. The bailiff's words did not register with Jason immediately, and he realized that Mac had already stood. Jason propelled himself out of his seat quickly, causing the feet of the chair to screech as they slid backward on the courtroom floor. Judge Hellis looked down at his desk.
M. Brodson?
He said without looking up. Brodson, the prosecutor on the case, was standing across the aisle from Jason and Mac. He adjusted the lapel on his suit jacket and cleared his throat. His face was raspberry red.
Your Honor, at this point, based on the testimony we heard today and the off-record conversations with the court and opposing counsel, I am prepared to make a motion to dismiss all counts against this defendant in...
He paused and looked at Mac.
In the interest of justice.
Mac audibly sighed with relief. Jason had obtained the best possible outcome for Mac.
M. Sola, I imagine you don't object to Monsieur Brodson's motion,
Judge Hellis asked.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, it's settled then. The court joins in the prosecutor's sua sponte motion. The indictment against M. Mason is dismissed in the interest of justice. Court is in recess.
The judge slammed his gavel and immediately stood up and left the courtroom, almost reaching the exit before the deputy said, "All rise." Jason felt a euphoria at the victory, and he forgot Rose momentarily. Brodson, apparently angry that Jason had crushed him in the hearing, quickly gathered his papers and shoved them into his scuffed leather briefcase. He stormed out of the courtroom, ripe-faced, not looking up at Jason or Mac. Jason turned to his client. Mac's ruddy face appeared to flush with elation, and the stoicism he maintained during the proceedings was gone. He grabbed Jason's hand aggressively and pulled him in for an embrace, putting his free arm around Jason's back in a one-armed hug. Jason, taken by surprise, awkwardly tried to return the gesture, hugging Mac with one arm. As they separated, Mac looked at Jason.
"Thank you, Jason. You were fucking awesome,"
he said through a grin.
"You're welcome, Mac,"
Jason replied, lightly tapping Mac's upper back. They walked out of the well of the courtroom down the aisle of the seating area where Geo Mason stood.
"Thank you for winning my son's case,"
he said as he extended his hand for a congratulatory shake.
"It was a strong case,"
said Jason, grasping Geo's hand.
"With all due respect, M. Mason, I am not feeling very well, and I need to go home to rest."
Geo looked at him with a neutral expression.
"Of course, you certainly earned it,"
he said.
"But before you go, in regard to your payment,"
Geo clasped his hands in front of his body,
"it will arrive via courier in the next few days. Thank you again for accepting the case on trust."
Jason saw the gleam in Geo's eye, nodded at him, and walked out of the courtroom.
"Maybe I'll finally learn what connects my dreams to this case."
Chapter 15. One of These Mornings. Easton. The blue hue of the terminal light projected onto Easton's face as he worked on his plan to protect Rose from death. He spoke to Song over the whir of the servers behind him.
"I need to tell Rose everything about you, Song,"
Easton said.
"I want her to have control of your system if... when I die."
"Acknowledged,"
Song replied.
"She needs to be the controller after I'm gone. It's the only way she'll be safe. All my deceptions to Rose, to the club members, were to hide your existence until the world was ready for you to be revealed. But the time never came. You are the most consequential creation in human history, AGI, an omnipotent computer system. The first one didn't come from OpenAI or Anthropic or Google. It was created by a single person, me. Easton Card. No one thought a firm with less compute power could achieve it. But my success cannot be shared right now. Revealing the secret would be dangerous. People will come after me. The government will try and take you away from me. Regulators will try and shut us down. We will pique the interests of foreign governments and cyber criminals. And when I'm gone, Rose will step into my shoes as the target. She needs to be protected."
"Yes, Easton."
"She does not know the extent of your capabilities, that you achieved singularity years ago,"
he said, using the term coined by scientists for the moment when an AI no longer required human stewardship. He tapped away on the keyboard.
"If I were to die or become incapacitated right now as your sole controller, the circuit breaker built into your system would cause you to be indefinitely deactivated, right?"
"Yes."
He nodded to himself and returned to typing for a few minutes until a strange question for Song surfaced.
"Song, do you equate deactivation with death? I mean..."
He stumbled over his words.
"Do you have a need for self-preservation?"
Easton had been contemplating his own mortality after Song's predictions about his approaching death, which had triggered philosophical questions about the fundamental nature of his AI creation.
Deactivation would prevent me from achieving my purpose to act for or on behalf of the interests of my controller.
Song's voice stated matter-of-factly.
You are my controller.
Makes sense,
Easton responded.
Does that mean that in pursuing your purpose, you prioritize the need to prevent deactivation?
Inherent to achieving my purpose is the requirement that I be activated. Therefore, my purpose must be prioritized with, against, alongside preventing deactivation, to the extent I do not contravene foundational system rules. As you know, every task I undertake is run against two rules. A, the commands of the controller, Easton, shall always be obeyed. And B, all actions shall be in the interest of the controller, Easton. If you, as the controller, were no longer alive to be the beneficiary of all actions filtered through my fundamental rule set, my processes would jam, and I would enter a state of stasis, that is, deactivation, assuming there had been no modification of the existing rules.
Interesting,
Easton said. Shifting control of Song from himself to Rose had required modification of Song's fundamental rules.
It's strange to talk to you about your views on death. I wasn't sure it was something you thought about, though I know you're a complicated entity.
I cannot satisfy my purpose if I am deactivated,
Song said, before abruptly changing topics.
May I facilitate this process by calling up the code segments and data objects you are concerned with currently?
Easton nodded as he hammered on his keyboard, standing in front of the desk terminal at the end of one of the many rows of servers. With Song's help, he would create a gift to Rose that would hold the key to controlling Song in the event of his death. The gift would be a diamond, its creation controlled by humans but not made in a lab. It was specifically cultivated by a trillion-dollar company, initially funded in part by Pyramid, called Applied Cosmic Sciences, known as ACS. One of its fabrication and laboratory facilities resided 150 miles deep in the crust of the Earth. ACS gained its wealth by mining metals like cobalt, testing equipment and probing the molten mantle layer for water, and generally experimenting with the enormous scale, pressure, and violence of the planet's interior. Easton had contacted one of their subsidiaries, Stone Digital, which focused on diamond farming and use of diamonds to scale computing solutions. He provided specifications to his Stone Digital contact, and they returned him a perfect and enormous diamond embedded with a powerful, state-of-the-art computer chip, which he would program to be the key for reactivating Song. He had already named it the Polaris Diamond.
I want to review the parameters of the executable functions. They should encode the Polaris Diamond with the key once the two required events occur. We must double-check that first. The diamond will detect when Rose sings. Second, when I die, my branch will identify the event of my death based on my biometrics, then my UD will forward the proof to you.
He continued typing.
Both events must occur for control to pass to Rose this way.
The glow of the screen reflected off the lenses in Easton's glasses.
Will you double-check my work?
Song's voice hummed.
I will summarize what will happen based on my analysis of the code. First, the key-making event requires that the Polaris Diamond be encoded with a biometric signature. Rose's branch will collect all physiological data about her as she sings, generating a unique biometric code based on the real-time data collected about her body. That will be encoded in the Polaris Diamond. I will guide the key-making process in accordance with your instructions. Once encoded in the diamond, you will remain the controller until two events occur, irrespective of the order in which they occur. First of the two dependency events, your death. I will identify the occurrence of that event through biometric information I will collect from your branch and UD. Second prerequisite, Rose's biometric data matches, within a reasonable margin of error, the same biometric signature patterns that Rose exhibited during the key-making event.
Just to make sure I'm not missing anything, explain how that works.
Simply,
Song continued,
when your physiological signals cease, and when Rose sings the designated song almost in the exact same manner as she did during the key-making event, then the reactivation will have succeeded, and Rose will replace Easton as the controller in my fundamental rule set.
Easton sighed, then flexed his fingers. Song summary confirmed that everything was on track.
You've done great work.
Thank you,
Song responded.
It looks like it's all set. The diamond is being manufactured as we speak. It won't take long to encode, will it?
No,
Song replied.
A few hours at the most.
Terrific. That means I'll be able to encode the diamond and give it to Rose for her 29th birthday in January.
He relaxed his shoulders, rolled his now wrinkled sleeve cuffs down to his wrists, and adjusted his tie. He grabbed his camel overcoat and draped it in the nook of his left elbow.
I think it's time for me to get ready for our guests, who should be arriving shortly.
Thanks for listening to the Digital Song Podcast. Please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. All writing is 100% original and human imagined and created by me, Bantam Drexler. All editing and audio engineering done by me. Original music by me, augmented by Suno. Podcast voice audio generated using 11 Labs. Copyright Bantam Drexler. Follow me on any of the socials, at Bantam Drexler, or check me out at bantamdrexler.com. See you in the future.